Hello everyone, you are listening to the TLU Student Podcast. My name is Jennifer from BFM, studying audiovisual media, and this is my co-host Laura from Tallinn University studying
Special Needs Education. Hello everyone.
We are very happy to have you here listening to us. The topic we are discussing today is the effect of social media, the insecurities and shifts of perception within that. Why did we choose this topic? I would say when we were brainstorming in the beginning of this project, social media was a topic that came up very fast, and I think it's because we all use it, most of us.
Yeah.
We have, I think, very different emotions regarding to it, triggers, and we just thought that we want to get into it more.
Yeah, it's something we use all the time, so it's interesting to talk about it. And we were inspired by one TED Talk video that we're gonna link in the description, so we highly recommend you watch it.
Yes, but enough of us. Let's welcome our guest, Maria Muruma-Mengel, who will be joining us in a few minutes on Zoom. So we're waiting for her to connect to get some academic insights on the topic. Maria, hello.
Hello, hello.
Maybe you could introduce yourself to our listeners. Tell us about what is your background.
I'm what one would refer to as an internet researcher, perhaps, and that means quite a lot. You know, in this term, there is some teaching, there is some studies, there is some public outreach, there is some just general lurking around in various corners of the digital spheres. But I work at the University of Tartu, and I work as an associate professor of media studies, which means that obviously I'm interested in all kinds of media, but my heart belongs to everything internet.
Very cool. What are you currently working on?
Currently, due to what is happening, I have become heavily invested in the topic of information wars, strategic communication, information disorders as a strategic tool for specific regimes. So this is not something that I particularly wanted to study, but with Russia's aggression towards Ukraine, the war that is going on, I think that very many media and communication scholars have had to make this turn, because right now, I think we all, you know, it's just all hands on deck.
Yeah, it's a hard time.
That's the question that, I mean, how did and why did you get into the field of social media? I think in the first place was our question, but you answered that it has shifted.
I mean, yeah, obviously. But if the war wasn't happening, I would probably be very interested in how social sanctioning in online spaces is taking place. You know, the cancel culture, the shaming of everyday people, of famous people, and how do these like micro aggressions and micro interventions turn into huge societal shifts. So that's what I would be doing, but unfortunately I can't right now.
Yeah, and we also, I think, came up with our topics and everything before every, so it's yeah. It's hard to, I know it in my personal life as well, doing things that are, let's say, entertainment related, you feel this guilt about doing things that seem so pointless.
Yeah, absolutely.
And insensitive. But they're, I mean, technically they're not insensitive, I guess, but it's still hard.
Yeah.
Yeah, it feels weird to just go back to business as usual. And the same goes for, because in today's academia, no researcher is just the researcher, but we are engaged in teaching, we are engaged in outreach, we are engaged in admin things, And it feels really weird to just go back to, you know, how everything was. And I can't. I have not done that. So everything has changed for me. And that means also that everything that is happening is echoing in the studies. It's echoing in the outreach. And, you know, it's just interwoven. But yeah. Obviously, we can't drop everything. Because
but we are keeping it in mind. We're keeping it in mind. We're in being considerate of it. I'm going to explain this digital study that we have just brought into this podcast, which I will connect to what you were just saying, that there's a digital study done in January 2021 saying that out of 7.8 billion people living on planet Earth, 4.2 billion are active social media users. And in Estonia, the number is out of our population of... the number of active social media users is 986,000, which of 74, that's the 74.4% of entire population. 700,000 are Facebook accounts and 440 are Instagram accounts. Just to be to the topic that we were, this war is also
in social media.
Yeah, the first touching all war of us. That, or I mean, What was so hard for me at first, you know, is when you are scrolling on TikTok and you see a soldier creating content, but showing what he is seeing. And it's very...
It's hard.
But it's like a simulation. It's weird because I don't think there has been a war where it has been so much... projected on in social media.
Absolutely. And this is something that has been gaining a lot of academic attention as well, because I know that there are loads and loads of people who are diligently working right now and trying to understand what does it mean for, you know, contemporary warfare, and what does it mean for us as, and this is going to sound awful, us as audiences, because we are
consuming.
Yeah, we are not consuming, but we are engaged in a certain kind of spectatorship. And even if it doesn't mean like a bad thing, like pass the popcorn kind of thing, but even if it means that I'm horrified, I'm driven to, you know, take a stance, to help out, to engage in activism, even if it's the outcome is this, like the common good, but still the role of a spectator in such a setting is horrifying. And it's, I think that we all, especially obviously those who are, you know, currently and presently physically in war, but also us as spectators, we have some collective trauma probably that we all have to deal with, because there is immense guilt that is tied to this spectatorship. Like, you are at your home in, you know, safety, and you are just, you know, mentally there, but there are actually people who are there.
But yeah, I think also the guilt that I live my happy, normal life while other people are suffering. Is it okay to live a normal life? Is it okay to be happy while I can be happy? You know?
Yeah. Yeah. And also, this is something to unpack after hopefully some kind of stability has arrived. But indeed, like, why are we so engaged with this war?
Yeah.
Why is the world fixated on Ukraine, but not previous things? But right now, I would advise against whataboutism. As a phenomenon, because, you know, it shifts the focus and it's a part of information war as well.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay. You have to find something else to talk about as well.
Yeah. But there was another study done in 2020 with kids aged 13 to 18 who were hospitalized for suicide attempts or had serious suicidal thoughts. And they shared their positive and negative experiences on social media. Would you want to guess them? There are
to start on something positive, there are four positive aspects that they brought up. What do you think about?
So probably there is a sense of community and belonging.
Yes.
That is one of the like main drives why we hang out in online spaces. So you're feeling like you're a part of something. Then I don't know if it's a separate category, because it could be, but it could be a part of the previous one, is identity building. You get a sense of yourself, who you are as a human being, as an individual, from, you know, comparing yourself upwards, downwards, social comparison, and from this act of belonging as well. Then I think that one really big thing is information. So you get information about stuff that you're interested in. And that can also mean that if you're interested in how to get thin in 2 months, you can also join like pro ANA communities or something like this and get info on that. So information is not good or bad, but, you know,
yeah,
you need different sorts of information. So I think that, yeah, information, belonging, escapism, probably. So if you're feeling like your life is really difficult, hard, you're dealing with some stuff that you don't want to deal with constantly, then you're probably seeking some kind of like forgetfulness, or, you know, just engaging in something completely different.
Yeah, like, yeah, there's a quote by someone who brought out social connections saying that my depression got worse every day, but when I met some pretty cool people online, they were helping me, they were making me happy. It was kind of a life-changing experience. So I think that is...
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. And probably one really important thing that people get from there is the emotional side, you know, very personal, that you get to feel things. You get to feel sadness, joy, self-worth, perhaps pride in stuff that you have done. So I think it's all there. Did I get some of them?
Most of them. So there was social connection that you said. There was positive content, like videos of cats and dogs or like clumsy people.
Yeah, feeling joy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just
emotion.
Yeah, just relief. Then accessing social support and resources for mental health and help and coping. Mm-hmm. That, people had people online who were going through the same thing, or who could relate and help them. And as you said, so shared interests like art, science, cars, news, politics, people could talk about
communities,
yeah. And find different people from around the world who were on the same page as you are.
Yeah, so you don't feel like you're the only one. You don't feel like, oh my God, there's nobody like me. Yeah. I must be the only one who is dealing with this. But that's what, you know, the digital platforms and social media is so awesome for, that however lonely you might feel, you will find somebody that is like you. So that will take away this kind of solitude that you perhaps don't even want to have. So this kind of bonding with people that you haven't seen, people who are living in very different places, but you're sharing something, right?
Yeah.
You could also probably find people who have it worse than you, and you feel like, maybe I could help them.
Yeah, but also if we go to the dark side, then we were talking about social comparison. So why we follow influencers, for example, is either because they're so cool and we want to be like them. So it's like this upwards social comparison where you aspire to be like somebody, but there is a lot of hate watching and hate reading and hate listening going on as well, which is a downward social comparison. You follow certain people on social media because you want to feel better than them. You can look at them and be like, well, at least I'm not like them.
Yeah, exactly.
So it goes both ways, right?
Yeah. So yeah, diving into the negative parts of it.
Yeah, there were seven negatives.
Seven negative things. Okay.
Four positive and seven negative.
I'm sure that they are overlapping somehow. Okay, let's see. So first probably is the positivity norm of social media, that you are feeling like you're the only one who doesn't travel, who doesn't have it all together, who doesn't look beautiful, who, you know, this kind of, everybody's posting, especially on like Instagram and very visual platforms, everybody's posting positive content, but you might not be there.
Yes, exactly.
You might be kind of sad about that.
Yeah, that's exactly the person. There was one girl who said that, why can't I just be like them? Why do I have to deal with all this mental stuff while they can just deal with the normal, happy lives? So it's exactly what you said, that this comparison of lives.
Yeah, but obviously it's not just social media, because this is, you know, everywhere. We tend to do this as social beings. We compare ourselves to others. So it's not just social media, social media definitely amplifies that. Okay, another thing that could be a negative would probably be harassment, especially if the respondents or the interviewees or you know, whoever is being quoted there are girls or women, then probably harassment is a big one, because it doesn't even matter what you are posting content on. If you're a woman, then there's a pretty good chance that you get rape threats, you get like harassed, you get dick pics sent your way, you get all of that. So this kind of unwanted, aggressive sexual attention towards women.
Yep.
I think that could be it.
Yeah, cyberbullying, hostility, and direct exclusion is one of the...
Okay. So harassment and cyberbullying, although very different things, but they could be put together. Then probably negative things that would make you actually like really traumatized. Probably disturbing content as well, because shocking content is attention grabbing, and you get a lot of reactions, you get a lot of interactions there. Algorithms will think that, oh, that was important, let's push that forward. So disturbing content can come in very many faces, but probably like a general approach of being, you know, of seeing that kind of content. Was that there?
It is triggering content, depressing, self-injurious content.
Yeah, and people were bringing up that you never know what might come up, especially like on YouTube, on Instagram, on TikTok. Well, it's all algorithm-based.
Yeah.
You can never know what to expect.
Mm-hmm. So, absolutely.
Yeah, you would be watching some funny videos and then something very triggering would come up.
But I would also say that although it is under the negative category, it has had a lot of positive outcomes, in the sense like this Netflix documentary, Don't Fuck With Cats, where they basically, this community on Facebook, or I don't, it was some other platform, or in addition to that, they saw someone abusing a cat, and then they started collectively trying to find this person, and he ended up being like a murderer and all these things. But, you know, people, of course, I think the trigger itself is negative on our mental state, but it can have moments of
awakening.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Then I think that one of the negative things could be what is often referred to as this kind of addiction discourse, that people are feeling and perceiving their social media use especially as addictive, as something that is not under control anymore. They're doing it too much. Like there is just like this, you know, too much of all things, smartphones, laptops, this kind of content that is, you know, avalanching towards you. So was that it?
Yes. Trouble regarding you / feeling addicted.
Yeah.
And it's like something I feel like most of us, especially younger generation, are feeling. For example, me, like I would be studying and then I just feel this need that I need to go on Instagram and see the highlights.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like it's an addiction.
It is.
Like I have, like if I'm sitting in my living room and my phone is charging in my bedroom, I feel kind of nauseous. I'm like, well, even though I have my smartwatch, so I know if someone calls me or messages me, I see it.
Yeah.
But somehow it's like, especially if I'm home alone,
mm-hmm.
if I'm home with my partner, then I don't worry about my phone. But if I'm home alone, and especially if I know that someone might message me, but mm-hmm. I can't answer them straight away,
yeah.
and or actually, I'm gonna miss out on a conversation.
Yeah, I actually was just filming my very first fiction film, because I'm in filmmaking, called the name of the film is Missed Call, and it the reason I wrote this screenplay has to do with I actually have a fear of. So I heard this thing that you shouldn't take your phone to the bedroom or whatnot and all these things. But why it is impossible for me is that because I have a paranoia or like pathological fear of death and death of a loved one. I have this thing where even if I'm at a theater and I should be putting it on airplane mode or something, I'm always scared that I will miss an important call. Or where, you know, but I was just like wondering that, is that a fear that comes because of the technology and being able, but if I wasn't in this period or wasn't born in this period of having that access, would that fear be translated through another way? Will I just not go out because mm-hmm. I would be fearful of someone close dying or these pathological fears? Or is
they're
it
tricky because the you know smartphones have brought with them and have amplified the feeling of constant connection. So we are connected with these micro communicative, you know, little hi smiley face, a meme here, a link there, just like I was thinking of you, a voice message, something like really short. And we're saying constantly to the ones that we love and care about or hate, sometimes we are very dedicated to the people who we hate, but we give like constant little, you know, these nudges and like waves to each other that you still matter to me. You are here. I am here. I'm okay. I'm thinking of you. And we have grown accustomed to this constant flow of connection and these kinds of, you know, this reinforcement of social bonds. So I think that if you wouldn't have a smartphone that would allow you to have this constant connection, you would get used to not being able to control and have information about your loved ones all the time, because that would just be your normality. You might be really anxious about this, especially if we have to transition from what is now to living without it. But if you wouldn't have what is now, you could have like anxiety, general anxiety. But I think that smartphones and constant connection is amplifying that feeling.
For sure.
So it brings us also calmness, because we can always check on our loved ones, and especially like, for example, if I know that younger people use this kind of like a social strategy for safety, that when they are leaving a party at, I don't know, 3 a.m. in the morning, then they will share their route via different tracking apps with their friends, or they are keeping a constant connection if they're in a taxi or something like this. Yeah. So that brings safety, right?
Yeah, for sure.
But also it gives us this constant connection with others that we might not know how to live without.
Exactly. Yeah, because I'm actually trying to get myself off of this addiction of like trying to be connected to my mother and father. But this has turned into I made them put on this Find My iPhone location so I don't actually have to call them, but I can just look at them when they're driving or something.
Isn't it worse?
It is, but I have to deal with it, and I will.
But so, it's quite similar because, for example, parenting apps, a huge market, you know, parents are willing to do the here, take my money type of thing, like everywhere. Mm-hmm. But tracking kids and tracking children via smartphones or apps or something like this is actually something that is really interesting for researchers as well, because it's a datafied childhood and it's this kind of sharenting mentality and like this overarching, ever-present, omnipresent parent who is always hovering, always in control, always has information and eyes on their kids. Because these tracking apps are actually really creepy. You can turn on your kid's smartwatch and listen to what's happening in the surrounding areas.
I mean, it's just funny because it's for us, it's the other way around. I do it to my parents. They don't do it ever to me. I do it to my parents. But then again, I guess the reasoning is that because social media, I would assume, is that because we are exposed to that triggering content. I don't know how many we have these murder mysteries, murder podcasts, all this, like, I don't think so much in Estonia, but definitely in the US, I think. I think in the 70s or 80s, you know, people were more naive to, but we're so exposed to all of this wildness. And then we have the smartphones, and then it makes us more anxious. And then we're trying to be more safe, but then it's for not for our mental health. And it's a lot.
But also, it's sometimes not the facts that make us feel unsafe, but the perception of what is going on. So mediatized understandings of public safety, for example. So if you get scandalous, very, you know, conflict-based gore and horror type of media that is, you know, dominating mediascapes, then you would actually perceive the world to be a very dangerous place when in actuality, all the crimes that might have gone down. I think that there was this book, Factfulness, Factfulness, that was all about it. How we perceive the world to be really, really dangerous when in actuality, it has gone safer in very many areas. And we tend to like over worry, but obviously, like one is too much with these crimes often. So we want to be able to like prevent them. But in the same time, I think it's really like worth the longer thought. So I can't imagine that because I'm not of that age, but I can imagine what it must be like if you are always watched, if you're always being surveilled, if you're being surveilled in school sphere, education sphere. So you have all these notifications that go from the e-school or studium or whatever. How you're doing in school is being metrified and it's being, you know, just like fed into these algorithms that make judgments about you of what could be a suitable track to you. How many points would you get? What should you choose? It's being like datafied and analyzed. And then you have your parents who are always with you. Because if I remember my teenage years and preteen years very correctly, one of the really important things that we did was just hang out. We would just, you know, talk stupid stuff and like do stupid stuff as well. But it was this unsupervised, unstructured time that allowed us to understand who we are, how we behave, what is okay with us, what is not okay with us. So this kind of norm building. Yeah. But right now, and this has been sociologically studied as well, like longitudinal studies, for example, in the States, of how children's time is structured. I think that there was one study that has been going on since the 50s or something. And what they are seeing very clearly is that children are becoming overburdened with all sorts of, you know, transportation movements and just like hobby schools and trainings and all of these kinds of stuff, and they don't have this time that, just like hanging out, you know, like being bored somewhere, just like throwing sticks and stones and being like, oh, so what do you think about the world?
Yeah.
You know, these kinds of moments. So we are over structuring and over surveying our children, which means that they might not get to be independent because they're always feeling like somebody's driving them from point A to B, where they have to play football, play piano, go home, do homework, then, you know, straight to school, then mom comes and picks me up, then I go there, then I go there. And there is no unstructured time. And also, like, constantly, even if you're running in your football training, your mom can hang out with you and be like, did you score a goal? Oh, my dear. Like, that's so creepy.
Constant mirroring. It's like, yeah. You cannot be yourself,
cannot be with yourself.
Yeah.
Obviously, it's always this kind of safety versus surveillance. You know, it's everywhere. It's in CCTV, on streets. Like, we allow ourselves to be surveilled because that brings us a sense of safety. If something happens, then it can be tracked on cameras, on video footage, and we can, you know who it was. But at the same time, we are offering our own privacy and our own, you know, being to this surveying machine.
It's like living in a reality show.
Yeah, in a way. But we, paradoxically, we feel really safe also because we don't think about the cameras. We don't think about the mutual surveillance that is going on social media. Like, all the time, there are eyeballs on you. You know, you're posting something. You don't see who sees that. You don't see who screenshots that. You don't see how that goes to live on somebody's weird little folder about you, perhaps even.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, yeah. these kinds of things stay very hidden from us. So we tend to think that, okay, I don't care. You know, it's the privacy paradox that Solovey has written about extensively, that we say that, okay, I have nothing to hide, so surveil me, have my data.
My thing, although I am, like, in contradiction, like, very paranoid and sometimes very fearful, but then at the same time, it does give me some weird sense of safety when I feel that I am surveillance. I'm like, they'll find my body, I'm being monitored. Like, it's so absurd, I know, but it's this, yeah. But I know it could be in another direction.
And obviously, we are little ego maniacs, all of us. We tend to go in our everyday lives and think that we are very valuable. Our thoughts matter, and we are awesome. And everybody thinks like that about themselves. So, of course, if we are so awesome, then we need to put it out there. We need to show how awesome we are. And what harm does it do? Like, everybody does that, right? Until, you know, because this whole idea of I have nothing to hide, which makes people share things on social media, is also built on I have nothing to hide right now from the people that I can think of. When in actuality, in 5 years, the regime could be, you know, have changed. So what you're posting now might become criminal later on. You might become, you know, cancelled because of something that you have posted, because social norms change, what is okay changes. And I think that we are slowly trying to cope and learn to live with this society, but it comes with its this heap of victims, people who have been cancelled or shamed or, you know, just like sanctioned really heavily because they made a bad joke somewhere, or people who did something that was deemed okay in this moment, mm-hmm. but not anymore. They are, you know, being punished because of that. There is like lots and lots of gray areas that we still try to navigate and try to understand how it works. But there are many casualties.
Yeah,
that you know, have to suffer until we figure it out.
For sure.
Do you think that you could be canceled for something?
Well, when this whole Ukrainian and Russian thing started, my mom called me and said, don't you dare posting anything on Instagram. Mm-hmm. Anything positive, anything negative, just don't like anything. It, like, everything might and will be used against you. I was like, mom, like why are you so worried about these things? She's like, just don't do it. Mm-hmm. So I feel like, especially now, it can be some, like, a big topic that might affect you in the future.
Absolutely.
So here, it's like, you need to raise your voice, to raise awareness, to say what you think is right. But then on the other hand, it's like, yeah, but you might go to jail for it in some time. Especially like...
Also staying quiet, you know, silence is communication as well. If you're looking at what's happening in Estonia, like Elina Nechayeva, Anna Veski, people who are deemed to be like important for certain cultures and groups, if they don't say anything, if they don't say anything, that's they follow your mom's you know, advice, they are also condemned.
Yeah, for sure. And
as they should be, in my opinion.
Yeah, but I think like in Estonia it's less of a problem, at least now, because we don't have like, you won't go to prison or you won't go to jail. But in Russia, it's a big thing right now, because you might go to jail for literally just saying the wrong information on social media, which any information can be wrong information, false information. So I know that a lot of people around the world are hating on people in Russia for being silent. But then you might try to save your country, but you as a person will end up in jail for 10 to 15 years. So you have your own personal life on one hand and your nation on the other hand. Mm-hmm. And like, why as a normal, regular person should I suffer if it's not even going to help?
It is. It's this tension between the individual and the societal, right?
Yeah.
So it's very hard to move away from yourself, because we are egomaniacs. And obviously, if I would be presented with a choice, go to the streets, protest, step up, and know that you will be beaten, raped, and, you know, thrown into jail, or stay silent and do nothing, I don't think it's a simple choice.
Yeah.
And I think that everybody who says, oh, you should do that, you should definitely go to the streets, I don't think that they have fully thought it through, like all the horrors that can happen to the individual within this horrible system.
Yeah.
They might be very discouraging. Yeah. But obviously, I can't agree fully with this kind of self-preservation being the only drive.
Yeah.
But we have been training really hard for this to be our only drive, because think of social media. Social media is very me-oriented. We are training every day to think about me, like how many likes will I get? How will people react to me? Which is the best picture of me? Which is my best angle? How am I going to sound here, look there? How am I in this? How will I get to retweet this? Will I do this? It's all about me. And less about us.
Yeah.
But what is expected right now, I think, is a strong sense of us. And I think that, I don't know, we might not be really well prepared for that.
Yeah, but the I was just thinking about simultaneously the question that what I would get canceled for. I feel like I've been a very good puppy on social media. I feel like I have been... I feel like the canceledness can come out of my personal conversations, because we do in my friend group, with my family, with my, you know, whatever, get into conversations where I've thought about that if this were to be heard, then it could be risky, because, but I think that's normal. I mean, you're challenging your friends, you challenge your family, you try to, but it's, this canceled, I'm sad that I think that it'll soon in Estonia be more prevalent, and as time is passing, I mean, some things I know that I don't think will happen here, like gender pronouns, because I mean, it'll be more of a topic, but in general, our language is limiting the amount of canceledness that we can have, because we don't have he or she, right? Mm-hmm. But the ideology will still be a question. The other day, I got into a fight with my brother, because my brother is very, Western, US media affected more than I am. I'm very much like Estonian media user, and he is very, and I was saying that, oh, like one day I would love to possibly buy an investment apartment in Kopli. And he was like, isn't that gentrification? Aren't you taking away for, and for me, it was like this total world of like, is that even possible in Estonia? And it was just this difference of what media you observe or use, or, and it's
how it affects you.
Yeah, for sure.
How it affects your perception.
But also, if we think about what you or my kids, or, you know, the younger generations, what's the world that they're going to likely to be living in? It's probably going to be more global. And this is very evident in younger generations' media use studies, that they rely on global channels, global, you know, newspapers, global sources. So that means that let's make it personal. If I know that my child is very likely to be working in an international team, like he's going to have, you know, people that are from all over the world, and they come each with their own cultural backgrounds and, you know, value systems and all of that, then I, as a parent, am really trying really hard to prepare him for that. That means that I'm teaching him to be okay with the pronoun discussions and all of that as well, because it doesn't matter that Estonian language is different. English isn't. And English is probably, it's going to be a very long, you know, change if something is about to change. So these discussions are probably going to be there in 10 years, in 20 years, when my child is, you know, perhaps in the workforce and, you know, trying to build a professional career. So I don't think that we should ridicule these things. And we should be really, like, very aware of how current professional lives are about to shift to a more global and, you know, more varied and intermixed and all of these kinds of scenes. And also, I think that your worry about sanctioning people and how this kind of cancel stuff is going to get heavier and heavier in Estonia, I think that the fact that we call it canceling is misleading. Because in actuality, we don't cancel people. Alarik Kivisaari is still working as a host, both in TV and radio. He wasn't canceled. Peter Helme is still writing books. He wasn't canceled. Lots and lots of politicians who have done some real Nazi stuff, they haven't been canceled because they're still politicians who are making money and having symbolic power.
By us, our generation, for sure. But we are not the ones who can affect whether or not, like, Alarik Kivisaari is working in radio or not. That's, like, he's definitely cancelled.
It's not cancelling. You know, the term is wrong because it's actually, you have, like, in very old criminology studies, there has been this division of all sanctioning. All social sanctioning, the things we do to each other that is outside of the law. So the law will put you to jail, give you a fine, you know, do all of these things. But there is a whole bunch of activities that don't follow the law. Rather, the law doesn't regulate them. So we as people, as communities, we have to like kind of regulate it ourselves. So we tend to sanction each other in two main ways. One is reintegrative sanctioning, and one is disintegrative sanctioning. So disintegrative sanctioning is cancel culture and canceling. That means that we will throw your ass out of our group and you are not welcome back. You are being shunned. You are being thrown out. Don't come back to us. So this is throwing people out as part of sanctioning. And this is what canceling refers to. When in actuality, what we're doing on social media is not canceling, but it's reintegrative sanctioning, which means that we are saying, this is not cool with us. Change. Apologize. We will, you know, look at you angrily. We will talk at you angrily. But okay, yeah, you can hang around.
But that's kind of better. So, like, you give a person a chance to change, yeah, at least.
Yep.
Or at least see what they are saying.
But also because we have, I feel like if we have so much information, like just this Alari example is very relevant, is that because so many different areas and people are being canceled, then we kind of forget about it. We forgot, like, and that's why I think I think people are forgetful.
Yeah, but as society, I think we tend to forget bad things. But that are not very personal to us. Like, I'm probably not going to forget if someone hurt me, like directly me as a person. But like, let's say Ekre, like, they've been hating on Russian people forever. And now half a year later, they are pro-Russians. And a lot of Russian people forgot about it, forgot about all the hate. Like, people in Narva are voting for Ekre, which is like mind-blowing.
But it's something that I think psychology has explored to great depth, is how we as human beings and our brains and our whole kind of value worlds and how we think about social life, we avoid the dissonance. We don't want to get conflicted with ourselves. Like, we want the good to be good and the bad to be bad. And whatever needs to be, you know, forgotten or renegotiated, we're willing to do that in order to have this kind of clear view of things. And yeah, that's why we sometimes like somebody and we're willing to forgive the evil things that they do. Or we have somebody who has changed and morphed into something else that we like and we agree with. And thus we are like, oh yeah, I'm going to forget about that. I'm going to look over that. Because our brains can take this kind of, you know, pressure of constantly being conflicted and constantly being like, yeah, evil, but no evil. Yeah, evil, but no evil. I want what? No, I don't. You should. You can't handle life like that.
Yeah,
exactly. But to go back to our topic, we were talking about negative effects of social media, and we covered trouble regarding use, triggering content, cyberbullying, social comparison. So we have two more topics. What do you think?
Could it also be? What could it be? I don't know. Tell me.
Well, first, it's a burden related to friendship expectations, like being always available and respond immediately.
Constant connection, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we kind of covered that. So, and obviously there is FOMO, fear of missing out.
Yeah, fear of missing out.
Finding the same as sharing your location, finding out that via Snapchat, SnapMap, that your friends are together, and seeing pictures from parties that you were not invited to.
Yeah, and it's not just FOMO, because fear of missing out is very much based on information, that information wasn't available to me on a timely matter, and that's why I missed out.
Yeah.
But the things that you described are more social. I'm being excluded. I'm not being invited. I'm not being, you know, I'm not a part of that. So yeah, it's this belonging once again.
Yeah, Well, I think it's just the thing that you find it out on social media. Mm-hmm. You find it when you're home alone at night, feeling miserable. I don't know.
Yeah.
You see pictures of your friends together and no one invited you.
Yeah. A study done in England in 2021 showed that people with a high level of FOMO tend to compare themselves to others in terms of social status, living situation, achievements, and often suffer from anxiety when their friends aren't active on social media.
So they suffer when they see people on social media or their friends, they start comparing each other or themselves to them, to other people, but they also suffer when they don't see their friends on social media. So when their friends are mute, don't post anything, they're also anxious.
Mm. You're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, and I think this is connected to this one question that we had about regional social media issues, because we talk about that the generation is going more global. But there's still regional issues, I think, which is, I think, sometimes even like comic, because I think Estonia's main thing is that we live in this 9-month period of being in the dark, you know, we're tucked away, nothing's happening. And then sun is out. We Estonians are grilling festivals, summer houses, you know, and everything comes to life. And then you're suddenly like, I have to be everywhere and do all these things. But also, I mean, I know that it's prevalent in the States as well, but in Estonia, the same thing that you finish high school, you get into Tartu or you go to Tallinn, then you pose with your bachelor diploma in Tallinn. It's red, you know, you have those pictures. Then most likely you will get a job. Then you go on LinkedIn, you put that, I am now working here. You do this whole post. Then you might get a loan. You're going to put a picture of your keys. You're in first home. Then you're pregnant. Then you're this. So that's where I think, and I was going to say about my biggest social comparison, because when we first came up with this topic, we were going through social media comparison through the perception of body image, right? But
then we realize that it doesn't speak to us. Like, we don't really compare our bodies to things we see on social media, because yeah. I think we've been educated enough to know that there is Photoshop, there is good posing. I can pose so that I look good, and then I can relax my muscles and I have
And my perspective was that I struggle with my body image, but never because of somebody else. And for me, it was like, I look at my own old photos of myself, not people of other. And I'm like, oh, I used to look like this. What? But it's never because of somebody else. But I know a lot of people do, but we didn't have a lot of our own perspective on it. But where I do struggle is, like we said, LinkedIn, you know, these avalik.
Open.
Yeah, you see these CVs and, you know, they did this internship and then they got into this, and I might to myself try to up my profile, you know, put all these statuses and stuff, but you do compare, and it's hard not to.
It is. And I think that sociologists are talking about a quarter life crisis is an actual term that happens to people at 25, around 25, when there is this immense social pressure and the effectiveness, you know, you have to be, you know, the grind set, you know, that kind of like mentality. And if you're not there, if you don't follow the social script that has been, you know, driven to you via social media and, you know, traditional legacy media as well, Hollywood movies, all of that, they all reinforce that kind of life track, even if they are playing on the stereotype of not having everything together. Because very often, if you have like a media text that has a hero that is the opposite, then still within this is the normative what they are comparing themselves against. So if you have this kind of, you know, the hero of Netflix shows or a persona piece in a newspaper or, you know, social media account that you follow, that, and they always talk about like how my life is such a mess and it's a self-deprecating kind of crap show that I'm living in, and I don't have this and I don't have that, but I'm a proud flower mama and a cat mama and something like this, then you still know, you recognize the underlying, this kind of normative text that they are going against, that you should have kids, you should have it all together, you should have more than succulents to kind of, you know, take care of.
Yeah.
When, you know, it's not. And I'm really happy to see that kind of several scripts popping up here and there, and having choices more than like some time ago. But also this positivity norm on social media, exactly, the flexing on LinkedIn, the pictures of Instagram, the funniness of TikToks, the snarky comments on Twitter, and the travel pictures and baby pictures on Facebook. You know, they are a bit much.
Yeah. So maybe we're getting into the last portion of our interview, and maybe this is a very like general question, but what is your stance as a expert on social media? Do you think it's positive, negative, or neutral, but what is your stance in general?
In general, I think that obviously, as a researcher, I want to say that I'm somewhere in the middle, but I'm an optimist at heart, even if things are super dark. So I think that social media has immense potential to do good for humankind. And I think that we should also be very specific to focus from time to time on all the good things that social media is doing. Think about all the digital activism opportunities. Think about the feel-good, faith in humanity restored type of stories that you have read about, like kids that didn't have anybody showing up to their birthday parties, or grandfathers who have written poetry and nobody buys it, or and then, you know, the internet stomps in and makes it all amazing. Think about how fast information flows, how, you know, innovative that makes us, how great everything is and could be, like all of the good things.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I think that we screw it up because we're people, and people are horrible at times. Like, we are egotistic little maniacs, and also you know, as with normal everyday non-virtual life, same, people are horrible sometimes and they tend to ruin everything. But I strongly believe that if we make efforts and understand that social media is media and is a public good, not just a company that makes money. If we do that, if we can somehow manage that, which I'm not that, you know, a hundo on it now that Elon Musk has bought Twitter, then we could still salvage things. I really think that we should reframe social media not as a silly platform to, you know, share memes and some personal news on, but rather see it as an important infrastructure for public spaces. It's a public space, essentially. And we should be really, like, much bolder in creating laws and norms and regulating these spaces. It's not a jungle. It's not supposed to be a jungle. It was for a long time, and it was, you know, probably necessary to get things going, because the more you regulate something, the less we can do there. Same goes for science right now. Like, everything is so overregulated that if we want to understand how, for example, one of my recent things, if we want to understand how younger children, like not 18 plus or 16 plus or 14 plus, but under 14, what are their experiences, for example, with pornographic media? How have they, you know, seen that? What kind of effects might it have? We can't do these studies because ethics boards and the normative, you know, kind of structuring of everything makes it impossible, nearly impossible. Similarly, if you think about how, I don't know, drug testings or you know, development of several important machinery, if regulations would have been like they are now, these innovations would not have been done. Quite similarly, I don't think that social media, the internet, would have developed to anything that we have grown accustomed to technology-wise if the regulations would have been too hard from the get-go. Because in order for you to experiment, you need to have freedom.
Yeah.
But right now, I think we're past that with this specific medium, because right now we're seeing how much damage uncontrolled jungle-like mindset can do. So I think that the voices that are calling for the past 5 years already for stricter and more effective regulation, they might be right.
Yeah.
I can't believe I'm saying that, but because I've always been an advocate of freedom and, you know, like, let people do and innovate. But yeah, there's a lot of dark stuff.
Yeah. Can you give any practical advice to our listeners who suffer from constant social media comparison and FOMO, just to tie it all in?
Unfollow people. Come on. You have no obligation to follow and stay a follower. So if you're feeling that little pinch in your heart, unfollow them. That, I know it's super hard in sometimes, but that's like the main thing. Also, monitor your emotions. Like, is there perhaps a general mood that you associate with specific platforms? If it's not a good thing for you, and if it doesn't give you like this sweet torture, because we really like dark entertainment as well, like the Bad Felix doom scrolling, we like that. Our brain likes strong emotions. But if you're really seriously feeling like it's damaging to you, quit it. It's going to be really hard for a week or so, but later on you will probably understand, okay, the important content will leak to me in different platforms. My friends will deliver like the coolest stuff to me via messages and just like links or screenshots. So, for example, I gave up Instagram like quite a while ago already because I understood that the positivity norm was too much for me. Like my own social circles that I follow because of existing social bonds, there is a lot of performativity and, you know, just like posting awesome stuff as you would do. But at the time that I was feeling this kind of psychological pressure was the time where I was under a heavy workload. So I couldn't go traveling. I couldn't do anything. And I was feeling like my life was kind of, you know, not that. So I, as soon as I noticed that Instagram made me feel bad and sad about my own life, I didn't use it anymore. It was super hard in the beginning. But now I have these three friends who are like, I have to share this with you. Go check out this one. So they will mediate the most important and coolest stuff to me. And also TikTok. I was very hooked to TikTok for a while. And then I understood that it took 3-4 hours out of my day that I could have, you know, used otherwise. Like, for example, reading, looking at trash TV, or, you know, doing stuff with my family mostly. So
totally relating to.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I gave it up. And also now what I do is that I sometimes check out specific pages on different social media platforms, or just, you know, try to keep up in you know, other ways, like again with friends, of the most important stuff that is happening there, because I couldn't deal with having hours from every day taken away from.
Yeah.
Not taken away. I was giving that away. So I have agency.
Taking back your...
Yeah, taking back. And now I really love my students because they are mediating the most important trends and stuff that I don't understand. And they're like very patiently telling me, so Maria, there is this new trend. It's going to sound confusing, but listen to me. And it's awesome. It's so cool.
If I see a new trend and I already feel like I'm like two steps behind, I'm like, damn, next time I'll be right on the trend. But it's, we need to get off of that.
Yeah.
And I will do my best.
Yeah, but also, you know, just the general feeling of guilt is sometimes not coming from inside of you. Although it might feel like it's a genuine feeling. But it might be a guilt that is placed on you and your generation. Because think of everything that, I'm going to stereotype here. Think about the stuff that the teachers are saying towards young people, that the media texts are saying, that general like policy makers are saying. It's always this kind of moral panicky, techno panicky. Oh my God, the kids are doomed. They're not doing things like we used to do. So you are the guilty part. You are the one with the smartphone neck and the long thumbs and, you know, with the red eyes and no eye connection opportunities anymore. So you are the guilty ones. But in actuality, no, you're not. It's just that the world is different from what it used to be. And quite similarly, like, for example, I'm 30. What? Sorry. I'm 37 probably.
Probably. It's hard to keep track.
I'm around 37. That means that my generation's growing pains overlapped with the generation of MTV and music videos. Oh, holy hell, how much crap I took for watching music videos. Mm-hmm. Like, I was told that my generation is going to be this rotten brained, you know, this kind of repetitive, ruined, over-sexualized, you know, you're just like a zombie watching this MTV with its stupid music videos that are not going to matter. And they are just like booty shaking everywhere. And, you know, this is going to ruin you and your generation. I don't know. Perhaps. I don't know. But before that, it was, I don't know, it was TV. And if it wasn't TV, then it was them tunes that they were playing on the radio. And if it wasn't them tunes that they were playing on the radio, it was the written word in the newspapers. Because what you mean you throw away written words? Like, you know, books are meant, the written word is sacred. And if it wasn't the newspapers, it was the books. Because what you mean you are writing down words? Words are meant to be spoken.
Yeah. Come on.
You know, all of that. There's always panic when things change. And some of that is justified because, yes, it's going to ruin some things in us and around us. But also it's, you know, the world is changing. That's it.
We didn't choose to be born.
Yeah.
I guess. Is that what you want to end with?
We didn't choose to be born. I guess we just have to deal with what we have.
Yes, we shall.
Do our best. Manage our screen time.
Yeah. But thank you so much, Maria, for giving us such great insights and doing this episode with us. And yeah, I hope this gave for you also something. And we wish you the best in everything that you do. And for our listeners, we want to thank them for listening.
For joining us today.
Yes. And till next time. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me. And I did learn a lot. And I do think about a couple of things differently right now. So forgive me if I've been, you know, too all over the place with my talk and perhaps too personal with some stories. But I'm sure that we all have, you know, room for development, like each and every one of us.
Thank you so much.
Bye. Okay.